And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. If you are a parent concerned about your child's weight, help is as close as your smartphone. A new app by Weight Watchers is designed to help kids ages 8 to 17 reach a healthier weight by developing healthy habits for life. For an added fee, you can work with a personal coach through video and text. The app is called Curbo, and it's getting some backlash. Multiple petitions on change.org calling for the app's removal have garnered tens of thousands of signatures. Parents, pediatricians, and others are concerned that the app may cause some children to develop unhealthy body images at best and eating disorders at worst, which leads to the question, how can we teach kids to develop lifelong healthy eating habits without dieting, shaming, or otherwise harming their relationship with food and their own bodies? Well, to answer that question, we have two guests. Charlotte Markey is professor of psychology at Rutgers University in Camden. She's the author of Smart People Don't Diet, How the Latest Science Can Help You Lose Weight Permanently, and the soon-to-be-released The Body Image Book for Girls. Virginia Soule Smith is a journalist and contributing editor for Parents Magazine. She is the author of The Eating Instinct, Food Culture, Body Image, and Guilt in America. Welcome to you both.
Thank you
for having me.
So first, let's talk about the app. And Virginia, let me start with you because you have written about this, the Weight Watchers app called Curbo. How does it work exactly?
So I reported on the app for the New York Times parenting section. And in order to write that piece, I spent a fair amount of time in the app. And so, you know, creating a profile and kind of going through the motions with it. What it has kids do is create a profile where they're asked to enter their height and weight and then set a goal. And it doesn't have to be a weight loss goal, but that is one of the first options presented. And then what it has them do, whether they've set a weight loss goal or not, is start tracking their activity level and their food. And when they start logging their food, the app classifies the food using the traffic light system, which was developed out of Stanford. And the traffic light system gives foods either a green light, yellow light, or red light. So right away, we're breaking down foods into good foods, okay foods, and bad foods. And what gets really complicated is the green light foods, according to the Curbo app, are really just things like fruits and vegetables, and then a few very, very low calorie items like vinegar or seltzer water. I mean, it's not nearly enough. Of course, we want kids eating fruits and vegetables, but it's not nearly enough to make up a full meal. The red light category, on the other hand, includes tons of foods that a lot of kids eat and enjoy every day as part of a healthy lifestyle. Things like peanut butter, granola bars, whole fat milk, whole fat yogurt, lots of foods that parents rely on to feed their kids. So it starts to get really confusing when we start labeling those foods as the red light or bad foods. And I think that's where a lot of the controversy has come from.
So Weight Watcher says that the app is backed by science. And as you just mentioned, based on Stanford University's pediatric weight control program, they say that it is designed to be, and I'm quoting from Weight Watchers now, holistic, rewarding, and inspirational. So kids, teens, and families get the tools and guidance they need to manage their environment and build and sustain healthy habits. Also, a Weight Watchers executive says that the Curbo app is not prescribing weight loss to kids. So, Virginia, just as a follow-up, and you talked about sort of the red light, green light syndrome and some of the issues with that. But beyond that, what's wrong with helping kids develop healthy habits?
Nothing's wrong with it, except that's marketing talk from Weight Watchers. You know, when you go to the Curbo website, the first thing you see are before and after pictures of kids as young as 8 talking about how many pounds they've lost or how many body index percentages they've dropped. So, you know, Weight Watchers is kind of wanting it both ways. They're wanting to say, we're not about weight anymore. We're not about diets. We're doing this holistic thing. But they're still relying heavily on diet culture marketing to get their message across. And so all over the app are tons of ways for kids to feel like their bodies are being classified in negative ways. So that, I think, is what we really need to focus on when we talk about the app is, you know, they're using a lot of language to say it's not dieting, but when you break it down, it absolutely is a diet.
Well, and it sort of has the feel then of social media and kind of the, you know, posting and comparing and that sort of thing. And I do want to talk with both of you about that in just a moment. But let me just stop here and let our listeners know how they can participate in our conversation. You can call us at 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And Charlotte, before I get to you, let me read this email from Cynthia, who says, I am the mother of a 10-year-old girl who has become aware of how her body is changing. I'm in favor of an app that shows kids how to make healthy food choices, as long as it shows that all foods can be enjoyed in moderation and does not steer a child toward a certain diet. So that comment from Cynthia. But Charlotte, I was reading that, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the prevalence of obesity among American children is 18.5%, or roughly 13.7 million children, one in five, just about. What are the short and long-term health risks that are associated with obesity?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we worry about, first of all, is that obesity in childhood predicts obesity later in life. So the immediate consequences of obesity may not be really obvious, right? We have kids who feel more insecure oftentimes in larger bodies. They may not develop the same relationships with their peers or significant others. So it becomes more interpersonal, I think, early in life. But then type 2 diabetes can rear its head, cancer, heart disease. Most of the preventable causes of death right now are related to weight status. And so that's, you know, the concern long term.
Yeah. Let me ask this, and I'd like for both of you to weigh in on this, because there has been of late this body positivity movement. And Charlotte, I want to start with you on this. And my understanding of it is that, you know, all bodies are good bodies, and we need to have a healthy respect and understand that people come in all shapes and sizes, and that's okay. What is your take on the body positivity movement?
Well, I definitely consider myself a part of the body positivity movement. And I think that everything you just said is really important, and that we want young people to grow up feeling like diverse bodies in terms of size and shape are all beautiful. So acceptance is an important first step in terms of our health. But that isn't necessarily mutually exclusive with developing healthy habits. So that's where I think there's a lot of nuance that gets confusing for people, that yes, you can accept how you are, how you look. That doesn't mean, though, that then just, you know, eat Kit Kats, like, for all your meals, right? I mean, we'd all kind of like to do that some days, and I guess if we do it a few days a year, who cares, right?
Yeah.
But we're just not going to feel very good if we aren't at least a little bit attentive to our health. That doesn't necessarily mean that we want young kids logging all of their food choices according to red, yellow, and green lights, though.
Yeah. Virginia Soul Smith, I'd like for you to weigh in on that as well, because it occurred to me as I read about this that there is sort of a, you have to kind of thread the needle with this, it sounds like, that there's a delicate balance between being supportive and accepting and teaching our children that people do, in fact, come in all shapes and sizes, but also being aware that there are risks associated with carrying too much weight. And I wonder if sometimes we sort of swing too far to the other side of things.
To be honest with you, I don't think we've swung that far yet, because there's still so much stigma associated with living in a larger body, and kids in larger bodies and adults in larger bodies experience that daily. So, you know, I understand that concern, but I think we're still a ways away from the pendulum swinging all the way. I think what really needs to happen, and I totally agree with Charlotte, there's a ton of nuance to this, but, you know, one of the best things we could do is to shift the conversation away from weight as, you know, when people hear higher weight bodies are associated with all these health problems, they immediately assume that means that the larger body causes the health problems. When the science on that is a lot murkier, the relationship isn't always causal. Sometimes the weight is simply a correlating symptom. And it could also be some of the health problems are the result of the weight stigma you experience from living in a larger body. Doctors provide less compassionate care to their higher weight patients. They may skip, you know, patients that avoid going to the doctor because they know they're going to be treated poorly. And that leads to missing screenings and other early preventive care. So there's a lot of nuance to this that we need to break down. But I think one of the best things we can do for our kids is if we stop talking about health and weight as these really these linked concepts, and instead talk about health and healthy habits the same way we would with a smaller child as we do with a bigger child. I mean, we want all our kids having access to safe places to play. We want all our kids having access to healthy foods, learning about drinking enough water. That's not something that only kids in higher weight bodies need to be doing. So when we narrow the conversation to those kids, we're not only stigmatizing and sort of shaming them by saying, like, you need this special attention because your body is wrong. We're also ignoring the health needs of all the other kids. Whereas if we just talk about health, you know, healthy habits as what they are and the way they make you feel strong and have energy and help you grow, that's something that benefits all kids. And I don't think we're doing, then we're avoiding the whole issue of stigmatizing those bodies. So that's a way of bringing the body positive message to kids.
And I want to mention, we're having a couple of technical difficulties with Virginia's call. Virginia, I want you to hang on with us, and we're going to reestablish that call in just a few minutes when we take a break. But hang in with me for just a moment. I'd love to drill down on what Virginia just talked about in terms of the practical ways that we can help children, Charlotte. But let me read a couple of comments from our listeners specifically regarding the app. Yvonne says, kids don't need more pressure on them, especially this kind that, you know, this may be more about financial gain. And Rachel says, I'm so upset to hear about this app. As a woman, I'm horrified how conversations with other women always focus on body image. And now we're starting kids on this message, and it's like they don't have a chance. So some interesting remarks from our listeners there. Virginia, I'd like to expand on, Charlotte, I'd like to expand on what Virginia said about practical ways that parents can help kids, starting with not unwittingly passing our own sort of dysfunction, our own maybe unhealthy perspectives on food and on eating toward our children. How can parents fix that?
Yeah, it's tricky. Parenting is incredibly humbling. But I think, you know, one of the main things to do as a parent is to kind of not make too big a deal about food. So provide healthy options, try to model generally healthy eating, talk about, you know, are you hungry? Are you full? Do you really, you know, my son didn't want dinner one night this week. And I was like, seriously, you don't want dinner? Like, you have to sit down with us. And he's like, I'm really not hungry. I had a big lunch. And, you know, he's a teenager now and his eating habits are kind of erratic. And finally I just said, okay, fine. Like, you know, because I don't want to force him to eat if he really isn't hungry. And we're so used to having these scheduled meal times. It's very culturally prescribed, right? And it just doesn't always work that way for everybody. So I think being a little bit looser actually can be better. And just not talking about it a whole lot, because the more we focus on it, the more it becomes like this thing.
Right.
And what we really want is to raise intuitive eaters who, you know, are thoughtful and make some healthy choices. And as they become independent, are more involved in that. But in the beginning, just don't really think about it, because most of what's around them is pretty good.
Yeah. And I think that as I'm hearing you, I'm thinking back to my own childhood when the rules were very different and there was no such thing as not eating your dinner. I seem to remember my mom saying, you will eat it and like it,
right,
is what we were told. So we'll talk about that, the messages that parents communicate to their children and ways that we can maybe reverse some of those messages when Radio Times comes right back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are talking about how to help our children establish lifelong, healthy eating habits and not imposing some of our own perhaps dysfunctional or even outdated ways of thinking onto our children and then having them sort of have to work through that for the rest of their lives. So how do we teach children to have lifelong healthy eating habits and perhaps even fix some of our own wrong assumptions in the process? Our guests are Charlotte Markey. She is professor of psychology at Rutgers University. Virginia Soul-Smith is a journalist and contributing editor for Parents Magazine. We invite our listeners to contribute to the conversation as well. You can call us at 888-477-9499. email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. Again, that is @WHYY Radio Times. Perhaps you've got some stories of, eating dysfunction while you were growing up, or perhaps you've got some helpful ideas about what you're doing with your own children that our listeners can benefit from, but we'd love for you to participate in the conversation. Charlotte Markey, before we left off to take a break, we were talking about practical ways that parents can help their children and some of the mistakes, right, that parents can make in terms of imposing their own maybe outdated views on their children.
Right. I think that it's so tempting because we want our kids to be healthy, so we want to control something like their food. And I think we have to learn to sort of loosen the reins, let them pay attention to their own signals of hunger and satiety, and, you know, just kind of not make food such a big deal that it becomes then a problem.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one thing that I think the Weight Watchers app has gotten criticism for, rightly so, is this idea of the red light, right? That some things are, I mean, they say it's not totally forbidden, but I mean, a red light sounds kind of like something's forbidden, right?
It sounds like not a good idea.
It sounds, you know, instead I've always tried to use with kids when I'm either doing educational sessions in schools or even with my own kids, like everyday foods, sometimes foods, all the time foods, kind of like this slightly looser dichotomy of, you know, some things like eat with abandon, right? And other things like, yeah, just not as much, but sort of avoiding that category of like, this is really forbidden, because we all know what happens, even as adults, when something becomes really forbidden, it becomes really desirable.
We want it more.
Right. I mean, can you just imagine if we all grew up with parents who said like, you must eat that ice cream so that you can have some broccoli for dessert. Right. I mean, would we all be like running around like broccoli maniacs? I mean,
right.
Who knows? But I mean, hopefully my point is clear that, you know, sort of how we think about foods shapes our interests in them and shapes our habits then. So we don't want to place such an emphasis on this is good, this is bad, you can't have this, you can't do that. We really just want to enjoy food a lot more than most of us do.
Yeah.
Right.
Want to read a tweet from Jim, who says, food is fuel. Let's focus on what our plates look like and not what our body shape is. Explain the impact that food has to help us feel better. Virginia, I'd like you to talk about that, about sort of focusing on, you know, what food can do for us, and maybe taking the focus off of bodies and onto the plate. What do you say about that? Are you with us, Virginia? Oh, I wonder if we're still having some technical difficulties there. Well, Charlotte, I'll ask you to comment on that while we're working on getting Virginia back. We've been having some difficulty with that line. But anyway, that focus on... Virginia, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, here
she is.
Okay, great. So were you able to hear that?
Yes, I know.
Okay.
I can hear you fine. So
great.
Yeah, the food is fuel idea. I would love to speak to you. I think that's a start of the conversation. I don't think that's the whole conversation, especially with kids, because food is more than fuel for all of us. Food is comfort. Food is love. Food is, you know, when you think about how babies eat, the whole act of feeding a baby is this incredibly intimate bonding experience, whether you're breastfeeding or bottle feeding. It's crucial to how babies learn to relate to their caregivers. And so if we strip away the idea that food should be pleasure, we're missing a huge piece of what makes up healthy eating. And I really think, you know, all the research I did for my book, The Eating Instinct, and the reporting I've done for these articles, I hear over and over the people who are the most anxious about food are the people who don't feel like they have permission to take pleasure in food. Those are the people who find themselves restricting until they can't anymore, and then they're binging, who feel guilty whenever they eat the, quote, wrong foods. That's really not the message we want for our kids. So yes, food is fuel. Food helps your body grow. I think that's a great thing to talk about. I love talking with my daughters about how digestion works and how food moves through our body. I think that's like a really great way to start. But it's also great to encourage kids in their love of food, all kinds of food, because that's how you get away from that forbidden dichotomy that Charlotte was talking about, where you get away from the idea that there are these bad foods that you can't eat. Of course you can. You can take a lot of pleasure in them. And the other thing that is really interesting is when you start to take this more neutral, all foods are good foods attitude with kids,
they get much less fixated on the foods that we want them to eat less of. They neutralize. The power becomes much neutralized. I'm at a point with my daughters where I can put a plate of cookies on the table alongside dinner. They're very happy to see the cookies. They do eat them, but they, you know, take one and then they move on to the rest of the meal. It's not this sort of like manic, oh my gosh, I'm going to eat the whole box thing. Honestly, I myself didn't believe that was possible in any modern diet culture until I saw it working with them. But it's a really cool thing, and it's something I encourage parents to experiment with. If you can step back and give kids permission to listen to their bodies, you will certainly find in the beginning when you try to take those reins off that they get pretty excited and go mad. It evens out over time because they start to realize, you know, a lot of what kids fixate on foods is because they're worried they're not going to have it. There's a scarcity issue that comes into play. And so you can neutralize that mindset if you emphasize, yes, it's great to take pleasure in your food. It's great to sit and enjoy your meals and just, you know, not feel bad about that. Be unapologetic about your hunger and your taste preferences. I think that's a great message.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's something to be said for access, right? For knowing that it's there. And
yes,
after sort of the initial frenzy, as you mentioned, it becomes maybe not so big a deal to have cookies.
Which, you know, is another thing to mention with the whole Weight Watchers app. When we're talking to kids about red light foods, you know, when I was reporting the piece for the New York Times parenting section, the founder of Kerbo said to me, you know, we have kids coming back from school and saying, well, everything on my cafeteria tray is a red light food. What do I do? And she was sort of pleased about that. Like, it was proof that they were really learning what all these bad foods were. But I felt like, you know, for kids who are reliant on school lunches, which so many children are, you know, we have 1 in 5 kids living in a food insecure household. It's a pretty terrible message to tell kids, no, you can't trust the food you're getting served in your cafeteria. You can't trust the food that your parents are buying at the grocery store, especially if you're in a low-income household where resources are limited and food access is an issue. So that's another reason to be really mindful about not playing into this good food, bad food stuff. When we go there, we start to play into a lot of, you know, elitist, classist stuff about, you know, who has access to these foods. And that's not helpful, especially to kids who often, you know, they're not the ones making the decision at the grocery store. They're not in control of the budget, whether they're in a low-income household or not. They don't have the power to make those choices. So it's another reason to stay more neutral and more accepting of lots of different types of food.
Well, you're listening to Radio Times on WHYY-FM. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. And speaking of access, I want to read this from an email from Mbalia. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. But it says, I'd love to hear more about the consumer pressures of buying unhealthy foods. For instance, why is there a Dunkin' Donuts in every corner? That plus food deserts make it difficult for parents to ensure healthy choices, so shifting the blame to children seems like a cop-out. So perhaps one of you would like to take on that question about just sort of a perceived pressure to eat unhealthy foods because there is so much access. What do you say, Charlotte?
Yeah, I mean, it's really challenging to feed ourselves and our families well because there's just so many bad options everywhere you look, right? I think that you can't say every Dunkin' Donuts on every corner if you start telling your kids you can never go there. That's terrible. Again, you're going to encourage their interest. So we don't want to necessarily do that. I think more eating at home can be a really great thing. Participating in meal preparation and cooking and having fun in the kitchen can be really conducive to enjoying food, as Virginia was saying. So we want to have food at home that's as good as we can make it. An important thing to mention, too, is that there is some pretty good science to suggest that kids don't always like healthy foods initially, right? Like, I mean, why would they like broccoli initially or asparagus? But with repeated introduction of some of these foods, they will develop a liking. Mm. But it might not just be 2 or 3 times, it may be 8 or 9 times even. Yeah. So we want to keep offering the healthy stuff as much as we can, not fight about it. We don't want to say you must eat that. You know, it's like, try just one bite. Okay, that's it. Yeah. Now we're done.
And maybe to Virginia's point, you know, adding a little mac and cheese with that, right? So
right.
You're introducing the, you know, the healthy foods that you want them to develop an appreciation for, but also maybe Virginia mixing it in with some comfort foods and some things they're familiar with.
Absolutely. I think it's a really great strategy to always have on the table 1 or 2 foods that you know your child trust and feel safe around, whether you have a kid prone to food fixation or more of a cautious picky eater, it's a really useful strategy because kids need to know that they're going to come to a meal and be satisfied. We all want that. I mean, how miserable would it be for any of us to sit down to a table of totally unfamiliar, you know, new foods that are prepared in ways you're not familiar, you know, and you're hungry and you don't know what you're going to like. I mean, it's a really, if we put ourselves in the child's position, you can begin to understand why it's so tempting to gravitate over and over to those comfort foods, especially things like mac and cheese, chicken nuggets. These foods are very predictable. They always taste the same. Kids don't have the knowledge of, you know, the sort of fun of trying new foods yet. They don't have enough experience with food to know that. So it makes sense to offer some of that comfort food and then alongside that offer the new or the different vegetables, whatever it is you're mixing in. And if you can really sit on yourself and not make comments about, oh, you're going back for more mac and cheese and you're ignoring the salad, or, you know, if you can just stop that narration and just let them pick what they want from what's on the table, over time you'll see they start to get more adventurous. They start, you know, they see you eating and enjoying the different types of food, and that empowers them to do it over time. So yeah, it is a difficult road for parents, but a great resource for learning more about this is Ellen Satter's work, The Division of Responsibility, where she talks a lot about parents being in charge of what's offered and when meals happen, but kids are in charge of how much they eat and which foods they eat from the ones you offer. It takes a ton of pressure off, and there's a lot less fighting at the dinner table.
Yeah, and we've all got enough pressure, that's for sure. So
yes,
let's bring Zoe into our conversation, calling from New Jersey. Zoe, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, yes, how are you guys?
Doing fine, thank you.
And so I was just making a comment. I agree a lot about what everybody's saying about how parents address the topic really does affect how their child turns out. And just a personal story, I had two parents that were both overweight when they were younger, and so they carried over their own insecurities when, you know, raising me and everything. And they always were very restrictive and, you know, oh, you're taking seconds, that type of thing. And I, to this day, have a lot of eating disorders and an unhealthy relationship with food. Whereas I have a friend, who was much larger than I ever was, and her parents did not care at all. They let her eat whatever she wanted, and that was fine. And to this day, like, she just decided when she wanted to, when she wanted to lose weight, and she's healthier than anybody I ever know. But another comment that I had said was just, instead of focusing on people making bad decisions or, you know, we're all bad and unhealthy and that's why we're overweight, I really believe that we should be looking at what's in the food and why that's making us unhealthy or why that's making us overweight and why that's such a struggle that even if you make good decisions, sometimes the good decisions even have chemicals inside them that are altering our brains that make decisions, healthy or bad, much harder than they need to be. So that's where I really believe the discussion should be shifted, not from our decisions, but rather than what's going in our bodies.
Well, Zoe, thank you so much for that. And I'm sure that a lot of people can relate to, you know, parents who did the best they could at the time, but maybe left us with some things to work through as adults as it relates to food. An interesting point that she makes, Charlotte, about thinking about what is in food and how some of those things can affect us in negative ways.
Yeah, I mean, the food environment is certainly problematic, but then I think people need to be ready to change the food environment. And I think we're kind of on the brink of that, but not quite there yet. And a perfect example is some of the soda taxes that have been suggested and in some places like Philadelphia have passed, but with great resistance. And why is soda picked on? Because it's the one consumable thing, basically, that is most linked with weight status of any other food or beverage. So, I mean, it's sort of with good reason that we're picking on it. It's what, you know, in our day growing up, we would have been told that's empty calories.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
There's nothing good in it, and it's all bad.
And you would have been rarely allowed to have it.
And you would have been, you know. And again, and I mean, my kids have soda sometimes. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
But if you're consuming a lot of it, it's problematic. And so what's one way to reduce consumption? Well, taxes work, it turns out, or to limit availability. And there's been a lot of public resistance because people don't like being told or to feel like they're being told what they can and can't eat, yeah. or in this case, drink. Yeah. And so people, I think, have to be ready to accept some of that legislation, some different policy, and really sort of decide we're all on board here in terms of changing the food environment in ways that will make us all healthier. But, you know, Americans, we like our freedom of choice.
We do.
And there's more restriction in other ways in some European countries, not necessarily soda, but, you know, the sort of equivalent of the FDA is different in other countries.
So I want to read a tweet from Julie who says, I am the mother of a daughter who is in recovery from an eating disorder, and the new Weight Watchers app for kids is terrifying to me. No child should be attempting to lose weight without the supervision of medical professionals. And so we will say that there is some portion of that where, you know, there are some counselors available and that sort of thing that that parents and children can consult. But I think it really brings up an interesting point and something I'd like to talk with both of you about. And that is for the child who is struggling with their weight or for the child who maybe is at an unhealthy weight, Charlotte, what are some things that parents can do to help and not make matters worse?
Right. I mean, I think a first step may be a consult with a pediatrician, but pediatricians aren't trained to help with weight management. In fact, most physicians get maybe a day, sometimes a week, not much more
Wow.
of training about issues concerning food and body image. So yes, your pediatrician will weigh you. Yes, they should be a good source then for referrals in your geographic area, but that's not where you want to end things. In fact, you know, I've talked with a number of girls for my forthcoming book, The Body Image Book for Girls, and some of them have said that their pediatricians were actually the source of problems for them when they were young, that their pediatrician said they needed to lose weight. And, you know, hearing that from an authority figure is really problematic for children and parents. So I think doctors are generally, you know, more informed and more tactful than they used to be, but still they shouldn't be the last, you know, the last consult. We really want to see kids, you know, maybe meeting with a registered dietitian if we need some just advice about good food choices. But I just can't recommend the constant monitoring that the app might kind of require, right? Yeah. Or we don't want to take all the fun out of food. We don't want to make it a burden or a homework assignment. It's just very, very likely to backfire. We know that restriction tends not to work. So we really have to find a delicate balance between, you know, getting some good information maybe from the medical community, but then just really doing a lot of common sense things like having a lot of fruit and vegetables in the house.
Yeah. We will talk when we come back about practical things that parents and families can do to help everybody maintain a healthy weight. Also, we'll talk a little bit about eating disorders and where we are with that when Radio Times comes right back.
Welcome. Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and we are talking about a subject that I think requires a two-hour show at least. We're talking about how to help our children establish lifelong healthy eating habits and how to perhaps undo some of the damage that we or even our parents may have unwittingly created. We also want to talk about eating disorders and the impact of social media. That's coming up in our conversation. We invite our listeners to join in. You can call us at 888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. Once again, our guests are Charlotte Markey. She is professor of psychology at Rutgers University in Camden, and she has written some books about this very topic. Virginia Soul Smith is a journalist and contributing editor for Parents Magazine, has also written some books and numerous articles around these topics. So when we left off, we said we wanted to talk about practical ways that parents can help the child who is dealing with a weight issue, a child who maybe does need to, you know, lose some weight to be healthier? What are some ways, Virginia, I'll start with you on this, that parents can help that child in a way that doesn't make matters worse?
I think the most important thing is to, in every way possible, not single out this child because they have a body that doesn't conform to a cultural ideal of thinness. I think it's really important that if you want to make some changes to your family's overall eating habits, overall activity level, you do it as a team. Everybody in the family is participating. Everybody's going out for more walks, playing outside more. You know, everybody's doing this. It's not something we're doing for this one kid. It's not something only this kid is doing. Stories I hear over and over are from people whose parents had a separate cupboard in the kitchen with snacks for their heavier child, and the smaller children got to eat different foods. I mean, this is the kind of thing that really sets kids up for lifelong damage. So that's a really important thing, is to really shift your mindset away from this one child's body type, because we know that weight is not just a source of, it's not just a product of what we're eating. Weight is determined by genetics. It's determined by larger environmental factors, very much beyond our control. And what I think one of the best things you can do is shift your focus away from the idea that you're going to make your child's body smaller and focus much more on you're teaching them to listen to their bodies, to trust their bodies, honor their hunger and fullness cues, work through some of the emotional stuff that's come up around their bodies. At the same time, what I also want to say is I don't think you should pretend to a child in a bigger body that, you know, they're not bigger or that this isn't harder for them, because kids know they're getting teased at school. They're experiencing this stigma. So I think we have to say really honestly to these kids, it's super unfair that the world's going to hold this against you. It's super unfair that you're getting treated differently. And I'm here to support you in that. I'm here to advocate for you. And view this as a way that you're fighting for your child, not fighting against your child's body.
And Charlotte, as I was preparing for this conversation, I was reading about the importance of not emphasizing weight per se, not emphasizing numbers. And I think back, and you and I talked about this in the break, I think back to elementary school when once a year the nurse would come and would take our height and weight and would announce it to the whole room. So everybody knew how tall and everybody knew what everybody else weighed, which could really be, I mean, that's the kind of thing that might have you in therapy years later, I suppose. But talk about, you know, whether it's helpful or not to talk about weight per se and numbers on scales.
I mean, I think as a general rule, no, right? That every now and then you can put your kid on a scale and, or at least in our household, it's like, oh, wow, like this is how much you weigh because you're growing. Of course you should be weighing more. But the scales are hidden, or most of my adult life, I have not had a scale. Like I just...
Really?
Yeah, I mean, because you don't need it is the thing. You will go to a doctor often enough that you will be forced to be weighed there. You will know if all your pants don't button anymore that you've gained weight. And minor fluctuations you shouldn't pay attention to.
Yeah.
You know, because they're just life.
Yeah, right. And that's normal that we'll fluctuate a few pounds one way or the other. And not to panic about that sort of thing.
Right.
Want to talk about eating disorders, because... It seems that back in the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of publicity around anorexia and bulimia and the like. And now you don't hear about it so much, but I'm sure that that's not because those problems have gone away. How big an issue are eating disorders among children these days?
I mean, the rates of anorexia and bulimia are relatively low, so it's in the 1% to 3% of the adult population, and most of the statistics for adolescents are fairly similar. So it's not a huge, huge epidemic per se. But what I think people lose sight of is that they're really, really serious. And so they're incredibly chronic. The cure rate is pretty low. So some statistics suggest that it's about 10% of people who are diagnosed with a serious eating disorder that will really be like completely cured.
Wow.
And there's a 10% fatality rate, which is the highest of any mental health disorder. And then you're wondering, what about that 80% in the middle?
Right.
A lot of them are just really chronically disordered eating. So they may not fit the criteria of anorexia, right? They may have a stable, sort of stable weight, but they're still doing things well into their adulthood. People like avoiding social situations because of the food that will be there, or skipping meals even though they're really hungry, or cycling through every fad diet that comes out. And interestingly, and this is true of Curbo as well, you know, diets are not called diets in the last few years now, right? This, there is this movement away from the word diet. People recognize it as problematic. And so now everything is about wellness. But, you know, wellness is diet culture in disguise.
Just putting a new name on
it. You're just giving it a new label, but we're still doing the same thing, kind of.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we don't want people to be spending their entire life jumping from one strategy to another and always thinking, if I just really stick with this, this is going to work. It's just a really terrible way to live.
Yeah. And Virginia, we tend to think, when we think about eating disorders and we think about body image issues, we tend to think about girls primarily and teenage girls specifically, but this is an issue for boys as well. What do we know about how these kinds of issues impact young men?
So again, as Charlotte said, when you look at the numbers on this, you'll come away thinking like, oh, it's, you know, it's only impacting a really small percentage of boys, just like anorexia is only 1% of the population. One thing we're really starting to understand, though, is that a lot of those estimates have been off base because the criteria of the disorders themselves are so narrow and so focused, particularly with anorexia, which has a diagnostic criteria of reaching a very low body weight, which means anyone who otherwise checks every box on the diagnostic criteria list might not get diagnosed. Doctors are very inclined to ignore someone in a higher weight body who's exhibiting all the same behaviors as someone in a lower weight body. They're also inclined to ignore people of color when they present with these symptoms, gender nonconforming people and boys. You know, they think of anorexia as a thin white girl's problem. And so anyone who doesn't fit that mold is likely to get missed. And that's another reason why apps like this are so problematic, because they feed into this idea that if you're not a skinny white girl who's therefore at risk for an eating disorder, we want you to be doing these borderline disordered eating things to make your body smaller, which is exactly the wrong message. We don't want, nobody should be living with any kind of eating habit that would be flagged as an eating disorder if they just happen to have a different skin color or a different gender or a different body type. So a lot of what we understand about eating disorders now is that we've probably been really underdiagnosing the problems for a long time across genders, across races, and that's something that really needs to shift.
And Virginia, I was reading too that with boys, it's not always just about eating less, but sort of abusing proteins, you know, sort of the protein shakes and sort of bulking up in ways that are
macros,
harmful, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's the focus on macros. There's the focus on all these, you know, keto diets, like all these things that have a more masculine, you know, the marketing is much more macho in the way that they are sent to guys. And I've actually been interested, you know, in the reception to my book, The Eating Instinct. I have so many women coming up to me saying, yep, this is my life. This is my story, too. And then men come up and say, like, well, but of course, you know, we have to do X. Like, in many ways, men are still more steeped in diet culture, perhaps because there's been less awareness of the damage that it can do to them. So there is an interesting double standard there where, and I'll also notice it, you know, when I'm profiling families about their eating habits, I'll see dads saying some of the more food shaming things, whereas moms are a little more aware of the consequences of that. They've struggled more with their own body image, and dads are sort of coming out as like, but you know, I don't want you eating that junk. I don't want you getting, you know, big body and all that kind of stuff. So there is a lot of problems in terms of the kind of toxic masculinity in our culture and how that feeds a different pressure around bodies. And so it's not necessarily always about being thin. It might be about being built or being, you know, bulking up in different ways, but it's still the obsessive focus on food as this thing that you need to manipulate and control and count and track. And all of that disconnects you from actually listening to your body.
And Charlotte, you're nodding your head as you're listening to that. Are you seeing similar kinds of things in your work as well as it relates to boys and to men?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting, just piggybacking on what Virginia said, is that, you know, the rates of severe eating disorders may be low using particular diagnostic criteria. But then if you survey women or you just talk to even young boys, right, almost everyone's dissatisfied with their bodies. So maybe that's not a quote-unquote disorder typically, but we can't say that's all right. I mean, that's a real problem. If we're all kind of roaming around this world feeling bad about ourselves, or okay, we're all, that's an exaggeration, but we're looking at, you know, half of adult men and women are trying to diet at basically any given time, up to 90% of women saying they're dissatisfied with their bodies, the rates for girls and boys, depending on the study, it can be, you know, up to 60 or 70%. Wow. So, you know, that has consequences also. It does lead to adjustment in eating behaviors, often not in ways that we want to see, not healthy choices necessarily. We see, again, some real interpersonal consequences. And just it's a brain drain, right? I mean, I sometimes try to explain to young people, like, just don't think so much about this. This isn't that important. And I think a lot of us, you know, older women, we can appreciate that if we had just never spent hours worrying about this, like, who knows what we'd all be doing, right? I mean, just so many people I know have spent so much of their life worrying about this. And I just can't imagine my own kids or other young kids, you know, absorbed in that way. Yeah. Like, I just want them to go out into the world and do other things.
I want to talk about social media because we cannot ignore the influence of social media around all of this. And Virginia, I'm thinking about, you know, when I was growing up, we had teen magazines that we could read and, you know, you could look at these, you know, very thin celebrities and that sort of thing. But in this day and age, I mean, social media kind of puts it in your face all the time. What has the impact been, in your view, of social media as it relates to changing the way that young people think about their bodies, their health, and how they eat?
It's relentless, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I was thinking myself about, you know, 17 magazine used to show up in my mailbox once a month, or even when I had two or three subscriptions. It was still like the magazine came, I read it, I ripped out a few pages, and then I moved on with my day. Whereas now, you know, kids are on their smartphones and they're seeing this stuff all day long. There's no break. There's no waiting for a next issue. It's here's another influencer. Here's another influencer. Here's somebody else talking about their diet, talking about their body shape, photographing themselves in ways to really highlight their shape and, you know, from certain angles that are not realistic. And I think there's an interesting thing going on where kids are really smart and really savvy, and they all will tell you, you know about Photoshop, I know it's not real, but none of our brains are actually immune to Photoshop. I mean, when you look at it, it starts to seep into your brain. That starts to feel like the normal and what you should expect your body to look like. So that's hugely problematic, because as much as we sort of intellectually get that those images aren't real, it's not how we really, you know, we do absorb those messages. And the other thing is, of course, kids are putting photos of themselves on social media. And then, you know, there's all this fixation on how many likes they're getting and who's commenting and what kind of comments they're getting. And all of that is another way where, and this is all genders, but, you know, especially girls, I do worry about it, because what we're really saying, one is, you know, your body is this object. Your worth is related to how people perceive you. You know, it's a self-objectification thing that definitely leads to, you know, self-esteem issues, to dieting, to experimenting with all of this stuff. And so it's a huge factor. And I think, you know, answering that with another app that's going to lead to more focus on food and weight is just not the way to go. We need to be encouraging kids to be much, you know, more critical thinkers about media. We need to be teaching media literacy in schools, teaching kids how to disengage from this, how to curate their feeds so they're not following people who make them feel bad about themselves. That's actually something that's great advice for all of us. It's really liberating to stop following people that make you feel bad about your body. And it's weird how hard it is.
Yeah. It's easier said than done sometimes. There's something going on there that keeps us doing that. Charlotte, in our last minute or so, I'd like your thoughts about that, about how parents can help children on the social media side of things sort of keep all of that in perspective.
Yeah, I want to encourage parents to remember the acronym FACE. So FACE is for protective filtering. Help protect your kids by teaching them to filter out those bad influences. A is for avoiding. Sometimes we need to put the phones down. We need to teach kids to separate from social media. C is careful of comparisons. What we're seeing is not reality. We need to be really careful not to compare ourselves to that. And E is for evaluate, and this is the media literacy component of it, like Virginia was talking about. So we really have to get better at evaluating what we're seeing and reminding ourselves that this isn't necessarily a commentary on us.
Yeah. Great acronym to remember, FACE, F-A-C-E, filter, avoid, that means put the phone down sometimes, comparisons and evaluate, right? F-A-C-E. Great way to remember that. And I think also a great way to wrap up a great conversation, and I hope one that has been helpful for parents who are trying their best to raise healthy families. Let me take a moment to thank our guests, Charlotte Markey, who is a professor of psychology at Rutgers University. Her book is coming out called The Body Image Book for Girls. She's written a number of other books as well. Charlotte, thank you so much for being with us. And Virginia Soule Smith, a journalist and contributing editor for Parents Magazine. Virginia and Charlotte, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Our producers today have been John Ahrens, Debbie Bilder, and Kelsey Hansen. Our engineer is Al Banks. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. You have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY-FM.